Biopod. Biopod, the official podcast from the University of Edinburgh's School of Biological Sciences.
After a long summer holiday, Biopod is bouncing back with bags of enthusiasm. We have a jam-packed episode with Biopodders
Steve,
Joe,
Georgina,
Jess,
Montserrat
and Cheryl, and we'll be discovering
what mechanisms cause the most severe effects of malaria,
what it's like to study albatrosses on a sub-Antarctic island,
how our bodies control cholesterol levels,
how does the genetic blueprint of a butterfly help it avoid being eaten by predators,
how climate change could affect Colombian ground squirrel populations,
and how chromosomes like to party.
But before those stories, some news and events.
Biopod.
Dr. George C. McGavin, the eminent zoologist from the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, is to present a new BBC Natural History programme called Nature's Nighttime World. The author, lecturer, TV presenter and explorer has had a diverse and interesting career studying insects, ecology, evolution and conservation, but started this career as a zoology undergraduate at the University of Edinburgh.
A series of 9 free public lectures examining the global challenges facing society and the role of academia will take place every Tuesday evening at 6:30 p.m. in Appleton Tower, George Square. The series, which is entitled Our Changing World, begins on the 25th of September and runs until the 20th of November and is delivered by distinguished speakers in the field. Tickets must be booked in advance.
First Midlothian Science Festival will run from Saturday the 13th until Sunday the 21st of October. The series of events are for children, adults and families and will involve staff and students from the university. Expect to find out about cosmic rays, particle physics and meet Midlothian's very own Nobel Prize winner. Events are hosted at several venues throughout Midlothian. See our Facebook page for details.
Biopod.
Severe malaria caused by Plasmodium falciparum is a major worldwide cause of morbidity and mortality. Until now, different strains of the parasite have made it difficult to develop a vaccine that would be effective against all strains. However, Professor Alex Rowe of the Institute of Immunology and Infection Research, as part of an international collaboration, has discovered parasite proteins which share common characteristics between the strains. These proteins are responsible for the severe effects of malaria, causing infected red blood cells to bind together in a process known as rosetting. Georgina and Jess have found out more.
We asked Alex to explain a bit more about the aims of her research.
So the aim of the work in my lab is to try and understand how malaria parasites interact with human cells. And this is important because when patients suffer from life-threatening malaria, the underlying pathology that's going on here is that the parasites inside red blood cells are actually becoming sticky and are sticking to blood vessels and to other cells in the blood, and they're actually clogging up the flow of blood. And this is the thing that causes damage in people who have very serious, severe, life-threatening malaria. It's actually obstruction to the flow of blood. So we're trying to understand how this binding between the parasite and the human cells occurs at the molecular level so that we can then come up with drugs or vaccines to try and target those interactions and prevent some of the deaths from malaria.
Alex's research is part of an international collaboration between Edinburgh, Kenya, Mali, Cameroon and the Gambia. So Alex told us more about the practicalities of collaborative research.
So the parasites that we ended up studying that came from these different countries, we've actually collected over a number of years, mostly as part of other ongoing studies. So it's involved lots of people from my group getting to travel and go and spend some time in these countries, and in some circumstances, some of the researchers from Africa coming to spend some time working with us here in Edinburgh as well. So it's a two-way process.
Working overseas brings its own challenges. Alex spoke about one of her experiences.
At one of our sites, when we were doing some pilot experiments before collecting parasites, I was actually able to grow some of the parasites just at room temperature, because these things will only grow at body temperature, which is obviously 37 degrees. But it was so hot, it was actually about 40 degrees. And in the end, my parasites died at room temperature because it was too hot for them. So it just shows you there can be all kinds of different challenges.
Alex explains more about the rosetting process and how her and her group have worked in the lab here in Edinburgh to understand how this process works at the molecular level.
And particularly this process that we call rosetting, which is where the infected cells bind to uninfected red cells, and you get these big clusters of cells called rosettes forming. And the ability to form rosettes is very strongly linked to the most life-threatening clinical types of malaria. We select our parasites for rosetting, and then we study gene expression in the rosetting parasites compared to other parasites that don't form rosettes to work out which genes are responsible for the rosette formation. And what we did in this study was when we'd identified the parasite proteins, we raised antibodies to these proteins and we showed that we could inhibit the rosetting process using these antibodies.
This research in Edinburgh is the start of a long process that may enable scientists to create a treatment to prevent rosetting.
The major finding from this work is that the antibodies we've raised, we call it strain transcending. It just means that they work against lots and lots of different strains. They don't just work against the parasite that we grew in the lab. This is something that's been difficult to achieve with these particular types of malaria parasite proteins we're working with, because they're very diverse in terms of their sequence. So it isn't always obvious that antibodies that you raise against one will work effectively against others. The reason that we're trying to understand the molecular basis of how the malaria parasites bind to human cells is we'd like to come up with new treatments that actually stop the parasite from binding. But it wouldn't be something that would kill the parasite, it wouldn't be something that would prevent infection completely, it would just be something that would be aimed at reversing the most dangerous pathological processes that are making these people really seriously ill.
We enjoyed hearing about when Alex first realised that she had the results that she was hoping for.
So when I finally realised that the antibodies were working effectively, it was actually a really exciting moment. I was at home and I had the flu, it was in the winter, and I was curled up on the sofa looking through all these piles of data, and then looking at these recent experiments where the postdoc who did the work, called Ash Gumra, he'd started to test the antibodies against a wider range of strains, hadn't kind of warned me that this was the result he was getting. He'd just, given me some data to look at without really making any comment about it. So I was really surprised when I looked at it and found that actually these things were working. So that was a very pleasant surprise.
And finally, we asked Alex to sum up what motivates her and her team.
It is rewarding to work on something like malaria where you can see certainly the potential for making a difference. And I think particularly for members of the team who work on this, the more junior members of the lab and so on, for those people when they get the chance to work and the field sites and actually see malaria for real, then I think it's a very strong motivating force so that people really understand that they can make a difference.
Did you know that a Scotsman, Sir Ronald Ross, first demonstrated that mosquitoes transmit malaria in 1898? This was first announced in Edinburgh and later won him a Nobel Prize in 1902.
Biopod.
Biopod is on the road this episode to find out what PhD student Hannah Froy of the Institute of Evolutionary Biology was doing on a tiny subantarctic island about 1,000 kilometres southeast of the Falklands, which is only accessible by boat or ship-supported helicopter. Hannah stayed at the British Antarctic Survey Research Station on Bird Island for about 3 months earlier this year. She begins by telling us what sort of research the small group of scientists based on the island carry out on a regular basis.
Most of the work that goes on at Bird Island is long-term monitoring. So they keep an eye on the populations of penguins, seals and albatrosses. All the individuals on the island are ringed, so individually identified, and then they follow all their breeding attempts throughout their life, looking at partners, partnerships and egg size, chick size, breeding success and survival rates, and also diet analysis to see what they're eating, and that can help understand what populations of krill or fish or whatever in the area, which lots of other species depend on, what's going on with them as well.
As well as assisting in collecting data for the long-term studies, Hannah was also collecting additional data for her own PhD.
I was working on wandering albatrosses. I was doing some tracking work, putting little GPS loggers on wanderers to figure out where they're foraging. And particularly I'm interested in whether there's any differences between young individuals and old individuals, and whether that can explain differences in breeding success. Breeding success changes with age, and we found that first-time breeders particularly have really poor breeding success. And also in later life, when they're kind of reaching their 40s, albatrosses show quite reduced breeding success. So by looking at the foraging data, we're hoping to make some links between whether there's any difference in foraging distribution or foraging behaviour, which can help us understand why they're declining in breeding success.
To collect foraging data from wandering albatrosses, Hannah had to attach GPS devices to birds that were sitting on their nests incubating eggs, but looked like they might fly away soon. Here Hannah tells us more about these devices and how she got the data back after the bird's long foraging trip.
So you have to catch the bird again and take the device off its back. We only left them on for about 3 weeks. They're quite small little devices, so they only have a battery life of about 3 weeks. So it's kind of one foraging trip for a wandering albatross. But these new tiny GPS loggers, which record the data, are revolutionising the field of tracking animals because they're really, really cheap. Whereas previously, to track a bird, you would have to put a device worth of £800 on it. These things are only 40 quid or something, so it doesn't matter quite so much if they don't come back.
In addition, Hannah was collecting blood samples from the birds. Here she explains what she'll do with the samples when they're back in Edinburgh.
I will be using them to look at telomere length in the albatrosses and try and look at telomere dynamics. So telomeres are the protective caps on the ends of all vertebrate chromosomes, and there is a thought that they may be a kind of indicator of physiological state. So what are we doing is trying to link physiological state with demography and see if I can find any relationships between reproduction, survival and telomere length and telomere shortening rate.
As part of their routine work, researchers spend time monitoring populations of Gem 2 penguins, Antarctic fur seals and wandering albatrosses. It was during this routine work that Hannah had quite a unique experience.
So wanderers have this really highly ritualised courtship dance. And they're very sweet and mates pair for life, and they spend a lot of time bonding. And they have this wingspan of about 3 metres, which is quite incredible. So if you you can go in and sit amongst the wanderers when they're dancing with each other and they call to each other. And sometimes they get a bit confused and come over to you and get quite interested in getting preened by a wanderer with one of these terrifying 6-inch bills. It was quite an amazing experience.
Albatross populations are in decline. Hannah tells us more about this.
All 22 of the albatross species in the world are listed as either threatened or vulnerable by the IUCN because all of their populations are sadly in decline. And a lot of that is to do with the fact they're very long-lived and slow reproducing, so they only produce a single chick every breeding attempt, which only happens every 2 years in most of the species. And declines in population size have been attributed to mortality on longline fisheries, so the birds go after the bait on the longlines and they get hooked and pulled under the water and drown, unfortunately.
Anna also tells us how her research may help to reduce population decline.
To better understand how albatrosses use different foraging habitats and where they prefer to forage and find food, we can get a better understanding of their at-sea distribution, and therefore you can see where they overlap with fisheries and what fisheries might be the biggest threats to them, and hopefully target those fisheries for mitigation measures.
Hannah said that the base on Bird Island was very comfortable and well equipped with internet, phones, hot showers, good food and, very importantly, Antarctic clothing. Here she tells us about the cold weather.
On the way, going via the peninsula, it was pretty cold below the Antarctic Circle, but where I was working it was usually about 0 degrees, but then there's quite a cold wind, so it's maybe minus 20 with wind chill, but if you keep moving it's okay.
And finally, Hannah reveals a very interesting visitor.
We didn't have David Attenborough, but we did have Hugh Fernie Whittingstall, who came to make a programme about fishing in the area and about the local krill fishery, I think, for his fish fight series.
And although he did bake them a cake, unfortunately for Hannah,
he left before he cooked his dinner, which is quite disappointing.
Hannah's supervisors published findings from the longitudinal study earlier this year in the ecology journal Oikos. In the paper entitled Intrinsic Determinants of a Population Trend in Timing of Breeding in the Wandering Albatross, results show that some of the birds are breeding earlier in the season compared with 30 years ago. Links to the article are on our Facebook page.
Did you know that the wandering albatross has the largest wingspan of any living bird?
BioBite, bite-sized biology bulletin.
Dr. Stephen Watterson and Professor Peter Casal of the Division of Pathway Medicine have recently published new findings in the journal Biochemie about how our bodies make and control cholesterol levels.
Cholesterol is manufactured in liver cells from the foods we eat. And while high levels of cholesterol in our bodies is associated with narrowing of the arteries and an increased risk of heart disease and stroke, cholesterol is also vital for making cell membranes, hormones, and several other components which are required to ensure the body's normal function.
The new discovery that the Edinburgh research team have found is that when our body's immune systems are fighting off viral infections, the production of cholesterol is slowed down at every stage of the process, and thus our cholesterol levels are naturally suppressed.
This research may lead to the development of a new class of drug for treating high cholesterol that mimic the process of natural suppression seen in the human body. These new drugs would be a welcome development, as the conventional and commonly prescribed treatments known as statins often cause several side effects, including cataracts, muscle damage, and liver and kidney damage. These drugs block all cellular cholesterol production at one point, and therefore also block the production of cholesterol needed for maintaining a healthy body.
Biopod.
Butterfly DNA, like any other organism's DNA, contains 4 different nucleotide particles, or bases, represented by the letters A, T, C, and G. These bases are grouped together in a particular sequence to make the instructions that control most of life's functions.
By using appropriate tools to read the instructions hidden within the genome of a Peruvian butterfly, Heliconius, scientists have found out that different species of this butterfly had copied certain wing patterns by sharing genes in the past. Biopod's Eugene spoke to two scientists who took part in this research, published in August in the journal Molecular Ecology.
We are Dr. John Davey and Professor Mark Blackster. Both were part of a large consortium that sequenced the genome of a Peruvian butterfly called the Heliconius. So John and Mark, you're welcome to the Biopod.
Thank you.
So John, you spent a great deal of time trying to read the genome of a butterfly.
Yes.
How huge was this genome?
So the butterfly genome is about 300 megabases in size, so that's 300 million letters, which is about a tenth of the size of the human genome, but considerably larger than bacterium.
Mark, how did you go about this research? Was it difficult to gather and read all of this genomic information?
It was. Previously, when you wanted to do a project like this, you had to get a million euro grant and collaborate with one of the huge genome sequencing centres. In this case, what happened was a bunch of people who work on Heliconius got together, each put a small amount of money in the pot, and together we had enough money that we could use what are called next generation sequencing technologies to generate these data. So in fact, generating the data only took a matter of weeks. Putting all these single individual little bits of DNA we sequenced and turning them into the well-assembled genome took years.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed both of you are part of this consortium. So what was the exact role of Edinburgh in this research?
So we generated quite a lot of, not the raw data that went into the primary genome, but a lot of the secondary data, which we used to do some really interesting biological analyses. And then John was involved in doing a large amount of analysis.
Yes, so we didn't generate the initial genome assembly. Which was done by Alexei Zimin and Steven Salzberg over at the University of Maryland. But what you get with an initial genome assembly for most of the genomes that are coming out is thousands of large but still broken up scaffolds, so regions sort of hundreds of thousands of letters long, rather than the length of the full chromosomes, which are tens of millions of bases long. So what we've done is we've used a method called RAD sequencing to sequence a mapping cross of these butterflies to make a genetic map based on next generation sequencing data, and actually make a map of the chromosomes of this butterfly, and then put the genome scaffolds that were generated in Maryland onto this chromosomal map. And this means we can have a fairly good idea of what's going on across the whole genome. We can look at the structure of the genome, we can look at the shape of each chromosome, or the sequence of each chromosome, and try and understand where different genes are on the genome.
Right, so why are you particularly interested in this butterfly, the Heliconius?
So it's actually a classic example of evolution. It was the, I believe it's true to say, it was the first published example of natural selection following the origin of the species. So Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, and Henry Walter Bates came back off an 11-year journey down the Amazon, and he had actually gone out to collect examples of variation in the wild. He'd been inspired by an earlier book by Robert Chambers, which suggested that evolution happened, although his evidence wasn't very good. And Bates went out to the Amazon to say, well, does this happen? What's going on out in the wild? And he came back with all of these butterflies. And he read The Origin of Species when it was published, and he said, I've got something that can help with this. And what he had found was that there were multiple species of butterflies with a huge range of different wing patterns. And he could trace, as you move down the Amazon, transitions in the wing pattern. So you would have two butterflies that didn't look very much like each other, but then there were transitional forms where you could see one bit of the wing had disappeared or another one had appeared, and you could actually plot out a transition from one form to the other, which is basically what Darwin was saying about evolution, that there were going to be intermediate forms that had evolved from one another. But he also came across a mimicry behavior, which was that these butterflies are poisonous, or some of them are poisonous. Birds learn very early on not to eat these very, very brightly coloured butterflies because they taste horrible and they make the birds vomit. But what Bates had found, or what he believed he'd found, was that there were other butterflies that weren't poisonous but had the same wing patterns. And that they were just sort of along for the ride. They had copied the patterns from the poisonous butterflies, and they were just sort of surviving under the radar. They weren't getting eaten, but they were getting away with it because they weren't actually poisonous in their own right.
So how were they able to copy these patterns from the other butterflies?
That's the whole point, if you like, of studying these butterflies. It suddenly gives biologists a chance to understand how something like as complicated as mimicry can take place. Building a pattern on a butterfly wing is a very difficult thing to do. One of the things that we were able to show with colleagues in University College London, who are part of this consortium, is that indeed butterflies that were copying each other's wing patterns had actually shared genes in the past. The very genes that underpin the patterns on the wings are the ones that have been shared between these butterflies.
And John, so apart from sharing that stretch of DNA responsible for colour pattern, do you see any other genes that were shared between these different species that related to adaptation?
We haven't really looked into that yet. That's really the next thing to do.
One of the problems that we're left with is that we know the butterflies can tell each other apart. So we know that males and females who have the same wing patterns are more likely to mate with each other than ones that have different wing patterns. So how do they know what wing pattern they've got? So what's the connection between the patterning on the wing and the choice that its central nervous system makes in who to mate with? So some really interesting questions left after we've answered this big one. How do they share patterns? Now there's hundreds of other questions we can look at. What other genes have gone along with them? How do these genes affect behaviour? Do they also affect what food plants they go to, etc.? So I think it's opened up a whole new field.
Mark and John, thank you very much for your time.
That's okay.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
BioBite, bite-sized biology bulletin.
Plants and animals depend on environmental cues for getting the timing of vital annual events right, such as flowering, shedding leaves, breeding and hibernation. However, climate change threatens to affect these cues and potentially alter the biology of life cycles of these organisms.
An international team of scientists led by the universities of Edinburgh and Alberta studied the effects of climate change on hibernation patterns in Colombian ground squirrel populations. Colombian ground squirrels, which typically hibernate for 8 to 9 months of the year, were monitored during a 20-year study in the Rocky Mountains of Alberta, Canada. Analysis of these and climate data suggested that during winters and with heavier snowfall, squirrels emerge from hibernation later, an extra half day per year on average since the environmental cue to wake up was postponed. In addition, the study, which was published in Nature in August, found that in those years when squirrels emerged late, both mothers and pups were less likely to survive.
Colombian ground squirrel population growth declined during the study period, which is a trend that may continue if winters remain colder for longer.
Professor Luska Crook from the Institute of Evolutionary Biology was involved in this study.
The carnival landed in the meadows last month, but it wasn't the usual shows, rides and transgender performers. No, it was a chromosome carnival, an event designed to engage and educate about chromosomes.
A couple of researchers collaborated with the seemingly disparate world of Damp's Theatre Troupe to convey how chromosomes, 23 pairs of tightly packaged DNA that encode our genomes, are packed inside our cells and how they behave within that confined space.
Children acted as one copy of a chromosome. They were confined to a small area designated the cell space in which they had to move and dance. Two adults were also involved by portraying the microtubule organizing centers, which within the cell organize and capture the chromosomes using microtubules, here represented by ropes.
So dancing in pairs, the children tried to catch the microtubule ropes coming from the organizing centers. Once all the chromosomes had caught a tubule, the centers pulled one copy of a chromosome pair to their end of the cell, simulating the process involved in cell division.
But why were they doing this? Welcome Trust postdoc and soon-to-be Cancer Research UK principal investigator Sasha Kagansky explains.
A lot of people didn't know anything about chromosomes, but they just wanted to dance, and everyone has different ideas. So one of the most difficult thing is because for the theater that we are doing it with, the most important thing is aesthetic aspect and the human stories. For me, it was very important that we get a clear scientific message across as well, try to do to be as precise as possible. And also for me, I have a naive idea that maybe by playing the process, using our cells on the field, we can learn something new about how physically this 3D object move about in the cell, and maybe we can develop a testable hypothesis and test it in the tube afterwards. But the main idea is just to have fun, I think. Whoever wants can join this thing, and next time hopefully we'll have it bigger. Maybe we'll have first enough chromosomes for one cell, or if we'll try to be ambitious, we can simulate the appearance of a new human organism from one cell, and then having more and more participants in a huge field, and possibly see how cells divide to create a multicellular organism.
It's easy to see the benefits and rewards of this exercise, simplifying a complicated and abstract part of biology, making it fun and accessible to children and adults alike, and hopefully kindling a lifelong love of science, learning, and, in this case, even interpretive dance.
Good as an experiment. It was lots of fun as well. It doesn't need a lot of sophisticated equipment. It doesn't need a whole lot of planning. We organized it pretty much in 3 days. You just need people and a bit of music, a bit of ropes, and here we are.
Biopod. You can find links to the stories, events, and publications mentioned in this episode on our Facebook page, Biopod Edinburgh. And you can also follow us on Twitter, @BiopodEdinburgh. Or send us an email at biology.podcast@ed.ac.uk.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Biopod.